Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project, the interview podcast celebrating women in queer culture. My name's Alice Beverton-Palmer and normally I'm a DJ at London's venerable Royal Vauxhall Tavern, but right now all I'm doing is staying indoors in my PJs. I don't know about you, but I really miss clubbing. Today I'm talking to a self-described outspoken black lesbian, the fundraiser and campaigner Olivia Andrews. Olivia went viral a few weeks ago with her blog post Dear White Gays, where she wrote that as a black lesbian, I've been disappointed by the lack of acknowledgement of racism within the community itself. To white LGBTQ people, my blog post is a call to action. So obviously, as soon as I read that, I wanted to talk to Olivia and go on to ask her about her experiences of queer nightlife and prides and the particular kind of queer misogynoir she's faced as a black woman on the scene here in the UK. This is going to be the third season, and it started out being specifically women in gay male culture, because that's like my experience. Like, I've DJed at like gay clubs and, you know, most of my friends are gay men, but then the more people that I spoke to, the more I realized that patriarchy affects all queer women, like whether you want it to or not. White gay men are gonna have an impact on on the scene that you're part of. So when I saw your blog post, I was just like, this is perfect. So what was the first kind of queer space they found themselves in? So what was that for you?
I think I found myself in a lot of queer spaces online. Like, I grew up in a very kind of digital age. Like, I just wrote an article for HuffPost UK kind of on my experiences, and I mentioned how I was very like tuned into queer culture and like woman loving woman culture. I used to follow like Instagram and Twitter pages of like Girls Like Girls and was very tuned into that, but that was very digital and virtual. So I think the first time I was in a space that was like truly queer culture, I went to London Pride in 2014. So I would have been 16 at the time. Yeah, that was my first ever London Pride. And like, literally, it was a very spur of the moment decision with a friend, like with a couple of my friends, one who's pan woman and one who was a gay man. And we were just suddenly like, yeah, let's go to Pride. And like, even though it was literally like raining the whole day and we'd showed up really late, it still was like really amazing because I was like, oh my God, like these are loads and loads of people that are like me. That going to Pride at 16, and I think from that point, well, that was when I became very solid in my queer identity. From there onwards, yeah, because once I moved into sixth form, and then definitely once I moved to university, I was very, very solid in my identity, and that was really affirming and really, really nice for me. And then literally went to London Pride every year since. Didn't go last year, obviously, unfortunately, can't go this year. But it's been like a staple of my year. And I think the first time I went with a big group of friends was, Pride 2017, where I went with my girlfriend for the first time. That was the first Pride we went to together, and went with some of my friends who I'd been friends with for years, but had since come out and come to their own realizations. And that one was really, really nice and really reaffirming. But like I say, I did notice that even though I loved Pride in that space, it was very whitewashed. It was also very like corporate washed as well. I remember seeing Disney there and being like, why is Disney there? Kind of like, what does that have to do with anything? And then finding out about UK Black Pride. And I went to that for the first time last year. And that was like the feeling I had there, I just can't even explain, because it was like, oh my God, I'm in a queer space. And I'm also in a queer space with loads of people that look like me. And having those spaces is so, 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 so valuable. Like, I've gone to quite a lot of spaces for LGBT people of color in recent years, sort of from my final year of university, I've been going to those spaces and having people that understood those dual layers and like just get it on a level was so, so, so like life affirming and really made me feel proud. Every time I've gone to Pride, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm so glad like I am who I am. But then being in those specific spaces, I was like, I'm really glad I am who I am.
Yeah, it's funny how Pride every year, like if you go to the same one, is like a yardstick of your life, isn't it? It's like, okay, who am I with this year? Like, what gang have I got around me? And you see how it changes. I was going to ask you, because you said in
in your piece, you know, as white people look around the room at Pride, like acknowledge how many black people are in this space. Like, what do you think, like when we can have IRL prides, like what would make them more pro-black? What would make them more inclusive?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think it has to be done in a way that's not tokenistic. So as a lot of conversations are being had at the moment on like truly being anti-racist and acknowledging white privilege, it needs to ensure that that like continues and that it's not just the topic of the moment. And I mean, a little cynic in me is like, oh, is everybody just speaking about this now because it's the next big thing? But when something else happens, is everybody going to forget? And with something like trying to make Pride more inclusive and more open, I think it's about, I'm always a like absolute advocate for amplifying the most marginalized voices. And in terms of Pride spaces and it being sometimes quite dominated by white gay men, it's amplified the voices of, you know, LGBT people of color, particularly like black trans women, for example, and some of the most marginalized people in society, and they don't get their voices heard. And then, you know, we look back in history to Marsha P and Sylvia Rivera and see that black trans women and trans women of color were at the start of the movement. And so it's about valuing those voices all the way through. So in terms of like sort of looking to Pride next year and the next Pride in London in person and just general Pride across the country, it's about bringing people of colour in, particularly black people, bringing them in from the get-go and making sure it's not just like, we're just bringing you in for Pride Month as a consultant and then you leave. Like, lived experience is so, so important when guiding kind of the direction of things. And it's actually quite interesting because the charity I work for have started recently like a participation project where they're bringing in young people with lived experience. And I'm seeing the values of that, and I'm seeing how it's so important to make sure you're not doing it in a tokenistic way. Like, UK Black Pride itself came out of frustration, and it came out of not feeling like, I mean, it was started by a black lesbian, and it came from a place of just like wanting to be fully celebrated because these spaces weren't made for us. And with Pride Month continuing at the apex of this renewed focus on Black Lives Matter and anti-racism in general, it is really interesting to have people, and that's where I wrote Dear White Gays from, because you're having people in the LGBT community saying, oh, you know, I stand with Black Lives Matter and I stand with this and I'm not racist and how could I, because I'm in an inclusive community. But then you need to almost look back. It starts at home, and you need to look back within your own community and be like, is this space truly inclusive? Is it acknowledging everyone's needs, not just the majority's needs, which is the same for society in general?
Yeah, all these things are like just lenses, aren't they, of seeing those problems. I think it's interesting as well, like you can see the same thing in kind of white feminism and its issues with trans women as well. It's like sometimes people who are used to seeing themselves as marginalized can't recognize their privilege.
There's very much been like, I've spoken to people before where there's been a reluctance to recognize that. There's been it's a reluctance and almost like a hostile attitude. I've experienced hostile attitudes before of, well, you know, I'm a gay woman, so I am disadvantaged. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not saying that you're not, but then me as a black gay woman or somebody I know who is like a black, gay and disabled woman, that like there's multiple layers of disadvantage. And I think there kind of almost needs to be a shift in the cultural norm of like, recognizing that somebody might have more disadvantage than you and you might be experiencing more privilege than you previously thought isn't an attack on one individual. It's a reflection of society and a reflection of why society affording more privileges to somebody who is white and cis but LGBT versus a person of color, trans and disabled, etc. And it's kind of almost taking a step back from it of like just thinking of it as like, oh, this person's coming for me. They're not coming for you, they're coming for the whole system that perpetuates why you're above them.
And I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned clubbing, you mentioned gay clubs in the piece, and like, so on this podcast I've interviewed dozens of women, and you know, a lot of them, as well as finding like freedom and community in gay clubs, have also had dozen experiences. Like myself, like I've been groped on the dance floor, I've been disrespected as a DJ because I'm a woman. Like, are there particular issues you've experienced as a Black woman in gay clubs?
Absolutely, like without a doubt. And then I kind of touched on this in the piece I wrote for HuffPost, that it was really, really tiresome. And I made the decision to move away from mainstream LGBT clubs because I was so tired of being called sassy and fierce and girl. And I was like, I don't, like, it's coming from these like white gay men that don't know me, that have just seen me a second ago. And you're already placing all these stereotypes on me in a space where I'm just trying to enjoy myself. And, you know, like, it's a space for everybody to enjoy themselves. And obviously, more often than not, they are not coming from a bad place. But it's that lack of acknowledgement of how it would make another person feel. Because in the same way, like, thinking about people, like white people, white LGBT people in these spaces, they don't like that when they're in straight clubs, they're like, you know, they have their stereotypes projected onto them. And, you know, people are making them feel a bit annoyed and making them roll their eyes. So then coming into these other spaces, like, don't be the person to perpetuate it yourself. And I mean, like, I've had, yeah, so I've had that, which has made me quite annoyed. And then I've also had like worse things where people touch my hair, people on like, on the, I think almost every time I've been out to a gay club, somebody's touched my hair. Somebody's ran their fingers through my braids and asked me, how long does it take? Or is this your real hair? And it's just, and it's quite interesting because it's like, why do you think that that's okay to ask you? And I had a conversation with one of my close friends who is a Black lesbian herself, and we spoke about it because she wears hers in an afro and I often wear mine in braids like I am right now. And we're saying, like, we should just one day turn around and just like run our hands through somebody else's hair and be like, it's just so straight. And there's just like, no, can't at all. And then it would make you reflect on like, yeah, this is actually a really weird thing to be doing to somebody, to be just running my hands through their hair. And so, I mean, I've had that as well. And this didn't happen to me, but my friend, I shared her experience in the article I wrote for HuffPost, and this was, I think, the most recent time I'd been out to an LGBT bar. It was in Leeds. It was Viaduct Show Bar in Leeds. I'm going to put it on blast because this shouldn't have happened. And as we were, literally as we were leaving the bar, a white gay man spat in my friend's afro for some reason unbeknownst to us, and laughed when she turned back to him. She turned back to him and was kind of like, can I believe that that just happened? And he laughed, like, into his boyfriend or whatever man he was with. And it was like, how can somewhere like, and Viaduct Show Bar in Leeds is very much like a staple of the Leeds gay scene. It was, I think, the first LGBT place I went to in Leeds, as that's where I was just at for university. And I just, like, I couldn't believe it. And she was so upset afterwards. And we had a conversation. She was like, I'm just so tired of this. I get this all the time. So to then be in a space that's meant to be all inclusive and I'm meant to be able to celebrate my identity, I'm still having somebody do that. And it's just like, things like that have just made me want to completely remove myself from that scene. It's not just the microaggressions. It's not just the slight comments and the touching of my hair. Sometimes actual harassment happens, and it happens like very much more than once. And then in contrast, going to spaces specifically for queer people of colour. So I last year I started going to Pussy Palace, which is the event run for queer people of colour, and white LGBT people are welcome, but they actually come as allies and they have to pay an ally price. When I've been to there, so I've been to Pussy Palace a couple of times, and I felt so much more comfortable, and I felt so much less like I'm going to get any stereotypes and any aggression, like microaggressions, anything of the sort. Because as well, with that whole allied system and paying a little bit more, I feel like, especially from white gay men, because I've never really seen many white gay men there, there's a reluctance. So they stay in their space. And then it's nice because then the space is actually for us. And it is sad that I feel the need to go to a separate space and remove myself kind of from London's more common LGBT scene. Like, I can't tell you the last time I went to GAY. And it is sad, but at the same time, it's still valuable. And I think in an ideal world, we could be in a place where the two are like working together. Like, it would be wonderful to see something like Pride in London work alongside UK Black Pride. They both operate in the same space. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have the two separate spaces or the two separate events, but they don't have to be completely like isolated from one another. They could be working in harmony. And I think that's like, when we're trying to consider being anti-racist, specifically as LGBT people, it's about thinking, how can we work in harmony? How can we use whatever privileges we do have to help the people with much less?
Totally. And it's, if you look at who leads the culture, and like, I've heard so many good things about Pussy Palace and like the kind of cabaret you see there, and it goes back to like ballroom, and when people start coming, you know, as kind of tourists, it's that thing you have to manage where you're like, yes, we are at the cutting edge of culture, but like, who is this for? And yeah, it's always going to be a numbers game, isn't it, when you have a minority. The other thing I wanted to ask you was like, whether you think there's like a gender as well as a race element to what you've experienced in terms of racism.
Yeah.
So like, has the racism you've experienced been worse from white queer men compared to white queer women? Like, is there a queer misogynoir?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there has been racism from white queer women, but I would say it's not as aggressive. Like, for example, the situation about my friend that came from a white queer man with a white queer woman, it's kind of that like stereotype of like when you meet up with a, like when you meet a girl in the toilets and you're both pissed drunk and she's going, oh, I love you. But in this stage, it's kind of like they go that one step too far and then they go, I love your hair. And I'm like, no, please get your hands out of my hair. Like, I don't know where your hands have been. And like, that is something where I can tell it's like coming from a very misguided place that needs a bit more education. But yeah, I definitely say there's been some misogynoir with white gay men. There's been a lot of like reluctance. There's been quite a lot of rudeness as well. And like, very much like, either I'm seen as sassy and fierce or I'm seen as too loud. And the irony of that, that you're in spaces where you're meant to be celebrating your identity entirely, and I've been told, oh, you're too loud. You're a loud, angry Black woman. Like, I get that stereotype pushed on me a lot. And that is somewhere that's coming from a place of racism. And yeah, misogyny, that angry woman, the minute a woman is loud and is vocal and raises her voice. And like, I describe myself as outspoken Black lesbian. I don't keep quiet if I'm pissed off about something and if I see something that's wrong, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm angry and I'm yelling at you, like to slightly raise my voice or to speak on something. That is definitely coming from a place of misogyny and like upholding of the patriarchy. Men don't like to be challenged quite a lot, and I'm the type of person that's not afraid to challenge, and I've had a lot of pushback before. And in terms of especially just like gender in these spaces as well, like I say that, like, I love LGBT nightlife spaces, and especially once I turned 18 and I was able to get into clubs and bars, it was incredible. Like, the summer before I went to uni, I was running around London, going to everywhere I could. But I did notice a lot of, like, sexism in there as well. And it was quite nice, actually. I've been to She Bar a couple of times. The first time I went was when I was 18. It was me and a friend of mine who is also a lesbian. And it was really nice, and we almost felt like a lot safer. And the space was still maybe predominantly white, and me and this friend was, she's mixed race. But that didn't like come into play. I think I felt a bit more comfortable in that space. And I've since gone back to She Bar with my girlfriend, who's a white woman. And like, I've still felt very, very much comfortable. Like, the race aspect hasn't been as prominent there, because I feel like it is, like, the microaggressions, especially the sassy, fierce and angry Black women, that's perpetuated by white gay men often. And I don't experience it as badly. And like, the majority of, I'd say, my friendship group are, especially my friendship group from uni, are queer women and like gay women or bi women. and we've all experienced some form of like sexism.
Yeah, and it is interesting because I feel something that I haven't luckily seen around for a little while is white gay men saying that there's a black woman like inside of them, or they're in a black woman.
White gay men's like spirit animal before, and I'm just like,
Oh god, just to make it even worse.
I'm not your spirit animal, I'm a person, like I'm just trying to exist. It's very strange. And that's the type of thing that like that kind of microaggression is very, very harmful. And it's again kind of coming from a place of like exoticism, like, oh, there's a black woman inside of me. Like, no, there isn't. There's blood and guts inside of you, let's be real. And it's that othering and that exoticism and that I want to embody this black woman. I'm like, do you know the struggles of a black woman? Do you know how much a black woman carries on her from just living at that intersection? And then, like, you know, there's intergenerational trauma, sexism, misogyny, racism, like all of these. And to have that's a form of othering and like fetishization. And then like, oh my god, the fetishization of black gay men as well. My cousin is a black gay man, and we've had interesting conversations about this as well. And he's quite a bit older than me. He's in his 30s, so obviously he's been in the LGBT nightlife scene for a long time, and he's spoken about it and about his fetishized. And it's so problematic because on the one end of the spectrum, you'll have people on, like, especially this is a problem amongst gay men that I've spoken to gay men about, that you'll have people on Grindr say, no blacks, no Asians. That's not passed as racist. That's apparently seen as a preference. Then on the other end, you get a fetishization of, like, black men and, like, oh, I want to be with a black man and I've never been with a black man. And actually it's happened with some queer women as well, where they've, like, kind of fetishized friends of mine or people I've known and been like, oh, like, I want to be with a black girl. And it's, like, that fetishization and othering is a form of racism itself that I don't think people recognize.
Yeah, like, I have to say, when Grindr posted that announcement that they were going to get rid of the race filter, I was like, what?
Like, why was it allowed to exist in the first place?
It's a positive step.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, the other thing that I'm just like thinking out loud here, but when you say about like the whole kind of like, you know, in a black woman thing, it's so interesting that essentially potentially what they're saying is this is my personality and these are my attributes, but instead of like finding common ground there, it's this kind of unintentional, thoughtless, complete othering of people who you potentially have something in common with.
Absolutely. Like, I don't think there are people, like, they've said it before and then they don't question, like, why am I saying it and what is it I feel like I share in common? Because, like, generally on a general basis, like, I don't have very close connections with white gay men and I feel very othered from them. There needs to be, like, maybe a very frank and honest conversation amongst gay men of, like, why do we feel like our inner, like, our spirit animal is a black woman, but then we don't like them in our spaces and we want to push them out. And there's been a very much a history of racism and misogyny, and it's because it's very inherent. And even things like the whitewashing of the Stonewall riots, the Stonewall film that came out a few years ago, I think it was like 5 years ago, depicted a black man, and I was like, a white man, and I was like, no, like, what are you doing? And
I know
it's crazy in that respect. And that's, I think that's, and that is where I kind of started writing that Dear White Gays blog post from. It really wasn't meant to be a blog post originally. It was an Instagram caption, and then I was like, this is too long to be an Instagram caption. So I wrote it out and I sent it to a few of my friends who were LGBT people of color. And they were like, oh my god, like, you should post this somewhere, like, oh, like, you should start a WordPress or like whatever. And then I was actually thinking about it, I was like, I have quite a few things I could say, I could start a blog. But it came from me seeing the same people who run their hands through my hair or call me sassy or call me angry or call me loud, then tweeting and posting and Instagramming about Black Lives Matter. And I was like, you need to start this at home. Like, it all starts at home. And as somebody living with like a marginalized identity already, you need to address where it's coming from within your own community. Because there's racism alive and well in the LGBT community, and almost every LGBT person of color friend I have. Oh, that's such a clunky way of saying it, but every queer POC friend I have has experienced some form of racism or microaggression, which is really, really, it makes me kind of miserable to think about it. It's quite interesting because a lot of pushback that I've had on the Dear White Gays blog post from white gay men has been, but what about the homophobia in the black community? And the actually, it's only homophobia they mention. And I'm saying, I never said I wasn't speaking about that. I never said that that didn't exist just because I was focusing on one group. It's again that kind of hostility and reluctance of you're coming for me, you're coming for me, but what about this? And I'm like, that's a problem. I know. And I could write a whole blog post about my experience being somebody who's very, very black and proud and then feeling very, very isolated and marginalized from my black roots as a queer woman. I could write a book on that. But I'm not talking about that right now. And where is that, absolute, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction. Where is that coming from? Where is that uncomfortableness with being called out coming from? Address that. I know full well that the black community has a problem with homophobia, but I'm not talking about that right now. And that's what I mean about living in my intersection. I don't have to speak on every issue at once because I'd be exhausted. But... there's definitely a hostility and a reluctance, and I've noticed it the strongest with white gay men. I've seen it among some white gay women as well, but the strongest with white gay men.
Yeah, it's sad. I hope, and I think this goes for so many just women generally in their relationship with queer men, is there are so many gay icons who are women and who are black women in particular, and there's so much potential if people can look past stereotypes and look past putting people on a pedestal, seeing them as an iconic and people as a human and communicating on that level.
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting.
This is something I ask everyone to nominate another Dorothy, another queer woman or woman in queer culture who you think I should speak to.
Oh my god, there's so many that just rush to mind. I want to say so many people, but then I'm trying to evaluate, are they too tired to want to speak on a podcast at the moment? I would say it's gotta be Tanya Compass. I think she's just one of my favorite queer women out there at the moment. She's just so incredible and does so much. And I would definitely recommend that anybody speak to her. She's phenomenal, and it'd be really interesting probably to speak to her about Exist Loudly and all the money that she's raised for that, because she's not even just being able to run the Exist Loudly or the CIC herself, but she's been able to give loads of thousands now to six other organizations. So 100% I would say Tanya.
Yeah, she's amazing.
God, the work Tanya Compass has done is absolutely incredible. I don't know about you, but every time I see the fundraising total go up on Twitter, I've been blown away. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another legendary Dorothy, but until then, please do get in touch via Twitter. We're @Dorothy_podcast, and tell me what you thought of the episode and who I should speak to next.